It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferris. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up on Food Friday, you might be looking forward to lots of good food on Thanksgiving, but preparing and cooking it, maybe not so much. We'll get some advice on how to simplify our Thanksgiving meals so we can spend less time in the kitchen and more time with our guests. First, a jury has found Kyle Rittenhouse not guilty on all charges. That's after shooting three people last summer in Kenosha, killing two of them and injuring a third. The shootings took place during the unrest after the shooting of Jacob Blake. During the trial, the prosecution argued Rittenhouse provoked the violence by bringing a rifle to the protests. Defense attorneys said the shootings were in self-defense. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What's your reaction to the Rittenhouse verdict? Do you feel like the jury got it right or wrong? What did you think of how the trial went? What piece of evidence or testimony stood out most to you? And what do you think of self-defense laws? We'll be talking about that some today. Do you think they need to be changed? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. John Gross is a clinical associate professor of law at the University of Wisconsin Law School and director of the Public Defender Project. John, welcome back to Central Time.
Happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
Well, as we talked about last time you were on, a lot of this case centered around the concept of self-defense on all of these counts. Was that key to the verdict today?
I'm sure it was. I mean, although the jury doesn't tell us specifically why they found the defendant not guilty, it was very clear from the presentation of the evidence that Mr. Rittenhouse was asserting that he was privileged to use deadly force in self-defense. That's what the defense team argued. That's what the prosecution argued against, that he was not justified in doing that. And so with the acquittal on all of the counts, I think the message is that the jury was not convinced that he was not acting in self-defense.
You wrote in a piece that came out earlier today that you expected this acquittal, these not guilty verdicts, because of your reading of self-defense law. Looking at that narrowly, not looking at the wider context and political debates around the country regarding First and Second Amendment rights, you think that under the letter of the law was the right call?
I do. I know that the verdict will be frustrating for some folks. I know that they will look at this scenario and say, why is he privileged to use self-defense? He was a 17-year-old with a dangerous weapon. He was out when there was a curfew saying that he shouldn't be out. He was engaging with these other protesters and demonstrators. And so doesn't this amount to some type of provocation that does not allow him to resort to deadly force? But that simply is not the way the law is written. So I don't think if people are tempted to say they feel like the jury got it wrong, I don't think that's fair to say. I think the jury was following the law as it was given to them, and this is the result that the law dictates.
You went on to write, though, that the law should maybe change. What do you think we need to reexamine in our self-defense laws here in Wisconsin?
Well, I think there is this issue about openly carrying firearms, particularly firearms that are high capacity, are extremely dangerous in terms of being semi-automatic. Many people feel uncomfortable around those types of weapons in certain situations where it doesn't seem to be warranted, necessary, even useful to have those weapons openly carried. And I think the question becomes, do we want to think about perhaps regulating some of the situations in which we think it's appropriate to have those types of weapons? There are other issues about, at what point does someone gain the privilege to use self-defense? Is it enough that somebody is attempting to reach for the gun that you have when they're concerned about their own safety because you're carrying a gun? Does that provide justification for using deadly force? And so there are a lot of questions to ask about things like the standard of proof that we require. In this case, prosecutors needed to disprove beyond a reasonable doubt that Mr. Rittenhouse was acting in self-defense. And so they weren't able to do that. And I think, again, under the facts and circumstances of this case, I think the jury came to the right result. But if people feel strongly that this was not the right result, then the thing to look at is how we apply and how we define self-defense under the law.
How does Wisconsin's self-defense law compare to other states?
It's not inconsistent with what other states do. I don't want to suggest that Wisconsin is an outlier here. I don't think we are. But I think the question does come up, you know, when we talk about the use of deadly force and when we talk about the use of certain types of firearms, should we be thinking about making it harder for someone to claim that they were entitled to use a firearm to shoot someone? I'm not suggesting that, you know, I have a definitive answer about this, but I do think it's something that should be open for debate and discussion, especially if people think that the acquittal of Mr. Rittenhouse does not comport with their sense of justice. Then again, the discussion should be about how do we define self-defense? When is someone entitled to use it? And especially when it's self-defense with a deadly weapon like a firearm.
John Gross is with us, clinical associate professor of law at the University of Wisconsin Law School, director of the Public Defender Project, looking at the not guilty verdicts and all charges against Kyle Rittenhouse, the verdicts released earlier this afternoon. You can join in with your reactions or your questions for our guest at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll go to a caller now. Mitch is with us in East Troy. Mitch, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to just address the fact that it's interesting that in this case, the guy that pulled the Glock on Kyle Rittenhouse and was actually moving towards him and about to execute him in the head with his 9mm Glock was not even brought charges on. So I think it's interesting when we're talking about, you know, possibly relooking at the law itself about when you're allowed to defend yourself, that the prosecutor in this case didn't even bring charges on the guy that was under video evidence to have brought a Glock almost directly to the side of Kyle Rittenhouse's head.
Mitch, thanks for the call. I'm not sure, John, was that person charged? I honestly don't know.
No, that was Mr. Grosskreutz, and there was a question put to him during the trial about the fact that he was carrying a concealed weapon. He had previously had a permit to carry a concealed weapon. It had lapsed at the time of the shooting in Kenosha, and he talked about that a little bit on the stand, admitted that, but also said that he had, for all of his adult life, regularly carried a pistol with him in for purposes of self-defense.
Thanks for the call, Mitch. And a tricky thing about self-defense is it's easy to imagine situations in which both parties believe they are defending themselves. In this case, protesters may have believed that Kyle Rittenhouse, with his weapon, who had already shot someone at that point, maybe not knowing the circumstances, believed he was an active threat and could claim that they were acting in self-defense, as did Kyle Rittenhouse. Is there something to that?
There's absolutely something to that. And this is the type of volatile environment where Wisconsin's open carry law, you know, it may cause far more harm than any good, because in this type of chaotic environment that you saw that evening in Kenosha, there were people who were openly carrying firearms. There were people who had concealed firearms. There was a lot of confusion and chaos, demonstrations, counter demonstrations, people who said they were just there to try to keep order and protect property. And in that type of environment, it's very difficult to tell who is a threat to your safety when so many people are walking around with weapons. And so, you know, there is everybody has a Second Amendment right. Everybody has First Amendment rights. But I think one of the questions we have to sort of sort through is when people are demonstrating or exercising First Amendment rights, does it make sense in those environments to sanction the open carrying of firearms that could be perceived as threatening or could, frankly, diminish people's willingness to exercise their First Amendment rights if they're going to be confronted with a line of folks who are armed with these type of military-style weapons?
We're talking to John Gross, clinical associate professor of law at the University of Wisconsin Law School and director of the Public Defender Project. He's with us today to talk about the verdict in the Kyle Rittenhouse trial announced earlier today, the jury finding Rittenhouse not guilty on all charges. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What's your reaction to Rittenhouse being acquitted on all charges? Do you feel like justice has been served, or are you disappointed in the outcome? Do you think we need to revisit self-defense laws in Wisconsin or around the country? You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. We're picking up our conversation about today's verdict, finding Kyle Rittenhouse not guilty on all charges. John Gross is with us, clinical associate professor of law at the UW Law School, director of the Public Defender Project. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your reaction, with your questions for our guest. The number is 800-642-1234. Let's go back to your calls. Mark is with us in Milwaukee. Mark, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I am very disappointed but not surprised. I think the way the judge treated the prosecution in front of the jury biased the jury against the prosecution. I'm wondering if our guests could answer this question. Would the families of the victims be able to bring, or could there be civil rights actions brought against Rittenhouse in federal court?
Mark, thanks for the call. Let's tackle each of those in turn. First of all, John, observers, especially those hoping, I think, for a different outcome, thought they saw bias from the judge in this case against the prosecution. What are your thoughts on that?
I did not really perceive Judge Schroeder as being biased in this case. I think people had very strong opinions about this case going into it. We all knew what the facts of the case were. There were no surprises during the trial. And so if you started from the position where you believed Mr. Rittenhouse should be found guilty, then what rulings the judge made were filtered through that lens, right? And if you felt strongly in the other way, you again had a particular, I think, bias starting out. I think the judge was holding the prosecution to their burden of proof in this case. And it was something that in the end, they just couldn't meet.
And then Mark had also asked about possible civil suits from the families here. As I understand it, the state, after an acquittal, can't appeal that. The federal charges could be brought, but I don't think there's any movement toward doing that. Is there an opportunity? Are there grounds for someone to file civil suits, though?
I think the caller he mentioned civil rights, and that's not really something that would happen here because civil rights violations are committed by state actors. So if police officers were to commit a homicide and it was unjustified, then the federal agencies could investigate and there could be a prosecution in federal court. But there could also be civil filings in this case for wrongful death. Those filings might not be just against Mr. Rittenhouse. They might also include the city of Kenosha. And because of the conditions that existed that night, because of police officers at least tacitly approving the presence of Mr. Rittenhouse and other folks who were armed, and also there in violation of the curfew that had been set out. So there may be more litigation down the road, yes.
Thanks for the call, Mark, at 800-642-1234. We'll go to Erica now in Lake Tomahawk. Erica, hi.
Hello. I just wanted to, my thoughts on it. Now, I am a vet. I spent 6 years in the Army. I've been fired upon, and I've fired back. Carrying a weapon is an inherently aggressive act, and this punk didn't go down there to guard anything. He went down to shoot someone. They didn't seem to bring this out in the trial. He was marching around with that gun to his shoulder. Basically, I felt looking for someone to shoot. Well, by God, he did. And then he cried and felt bad for himself. Somebody's going to beat him up, conk him over the head with a skateboard, and he shot him dead. Well, that's like that's a pretty wicked response. And that didn't seem to come out in that. He went down there to kill someone.
Thanks for the call. John, that motivation, obviously the jury didn't see it that way, but also with open carry laws, there's nothing that says you, I guess, can't carry a weapon in that fashion, right?
That's correct. And the caller's point about viewing that behavior as inherently aggressive is really what gets to the heart of this issue. some people firmly believe that that Mr. Rittenhouse's behavior by arming himself in that way, by carrying that type of weapon in the way he was carrying it with it strapped to his body, that this suggests that he had some ill intent, that he was going there looking, as the caller said, to engage in violence, to shoot someone. And that in fact, going armed in that manner is provocative, it is a provocation for folks. And so if people responded by attempting to take the weapon away from him, or they responded aggressively toward him because of that, then he is essentially creating the dangerous situation where he feels he needs to use deadly force. And the law, to be clear, doesn't allow you to provoke the other person and then use deadly force. But with an open carry law, it's difficult to argue that he's doing something that is provocative. In fact, the legislature, when they passed the open carry law, they went back and rewrote the disorderly conduct statute to say that somebody openly carrying a gun absent some other evidence is not creating a disturbance. And that's where people differ.
Thanks for that call. We're talking about the verdict in the Kyle Rittenhouse charges, not guilty on those charges. John Gross is with us from UW Law School. Back to your calls now. We've got Jeff on the line in Schofield. Jeff, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What did you want to bring up?
Thanks for taking my call. This boy at the time was a victim of Old West justice. He was tried and in media the entire time. He was found guilty before the trial even started in the media and public opinion. The verdict was justified, and all these people with these opinions on what happened at that site, if you didn't watch the entire trial from beginning to end, you have no say in this, absolutely none, because they're speculating and they're guessing just like the media did from day one. Justice was finally done, and everybody that raged race against this thing, they're absolutely insane. I don't see where anybody that didn't watch the whole trial can have any voice in this whatsoever.
Jeff, thanks for the call. What do you think, John?
Well, again, this case has been polarizing from the start. And I often tell people that, you know, you can't, trials are not referendums on any type of a movement or an ideology. Criminal trial is just a very narrow proceeding where somebody's charged with a crime and the prosecution has to prove every element of those charges. They have to prove them beyond any reasonable doubt. And so the people, and I think sometimes various media outlets, want to put a particular spin on not just this case but other criminal trials, and I think that can be a dangerous thing. It really can be, because the trial, all that we learned today from the verdict was that the prosecution didn't prove those five cases beyond a reasonable doubt to that jury.
Thanks for that call. We'll go to Jimmy now in Valley Junction. Jimmy, hi.
Hello. I guess my concern is this kid's going to be a poster boy for anybody that thinks that with a rifle or a handgun, that thinks they want to show up to some kind of protest and, you know, make themselves a vigilante. I'm just afraid you're going to have both sides bringing weapons to things like this, and it's going to get out of hand, and pretty soon you're back in Deadwood, South Dakota in the 1880s, and I'll take my comments off the air.
Jimmy, thanks for that call. I've seen other people raise the concern, John, is this a blueprint for someone who wants to show up with a firearm on any side at any issue and hope they can find a justification to use it?
I mean, I think that is a legitimate concern in this case. I mean, I just... mentioned saying that we can't, you know, draw a lot of conclusions from an individual criminal case. But I think when we look at the way the law played out in this case, and the way the law of self-defense is, when you combine open carry of firearms and you combine people exercising their right to protest and petition, and you also have this environment where people are armed, yes, this is a volatile, dangerous environment. And what we don't want, as the caller said, is to create some type of blueprint for people who want to engage in some type of political violence and use open carry laws and self-defense laws as a kind of pretext to engage in that type of violence.
Thanks for the call. John, as I mentioned earlier, you wrote today that you hope we revisit and maybe rethink how we define self-defense and the standards for its use. Do you think that's likely to happen?
I don't know. I mean, I would have to say that, you know, this is a debate that is complex. It requires people to keep an open mind. It requires people to reach some type of compromise on Second Amendment rights. And there are many folks who are just unwilling to compromise those. And they see any type of limitation on their right to carry firearms or use them in self-defense as a constitutional violation of their rights. And so I would hope that the legislature would have a debate about this, think about what the law is, what it could be, what it should be, and do it in a way that's open and honest. But you know, we are very polarized. So it's a big ask that I'm making of folks.
John, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us again.
Oh, my pleasure. Happy to do it.
That's John Gross, Clinical Associate Professor of Law at the University of Wisconsin Law School and Director of the Public Defender Project. He was with us today to talk about the jury's decision in the Kyle Rittenhouse trial, finding him not guilty on all counts. You can follow further coverage from our news team over at WPR.org or watch stories as they post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Coming up after the news, it's this week's edition of Food Friday. We'll get some advice on simplifying our Thanksgiving meals so we can better enjoy the day with friends and family. You can share your Thanksgiving meal advice and tips, and if you'd like to avoid a lot of the hard work, over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. To Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. We're less than a week away from Thanksgiving. Maybe you're planning on doing the bulk of your shopping this weekend. Before we head out with that super long list, our next guest says, hang on, there's a better way. Do you really want to spend the entire holiday in the kitchen making complicated dishes? Would you rather spend more time with friends and family? Maybe even get to play in this year's Thanksgiving family touch football game? You can, and you don't have to sacrifice the quality of the food either. In this week's edition of Food Friday, we'll find out how to simplify our home-cooked Thanksgiving meal. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think is the most tedious part of cooking for Thanksgiving? Do you have shortcuts you like to use to make the prep and cooking process a little easier? Do you have to have a whole turkey, or can you have smaller amounts of turkey, or maybe something else altogether? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Eric Kim is a cooking writer for the New York Times Food Section, New York Times Cooking, and a columnist for the New York Times Magazine. He's the author of the forthcoming cookbook, Korean American Food That Tastes Like Home. Eric, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me. I'm so excited to be here.
I understand you've been cooking Thanksgiving dinner for your family since you were 13. How did that get started?
Yeah, I tell people that and they don't understand. Yeah, I think it had to do with just being a child of immigrants, and I had parents who didn't cook American food. So, you know, all the kids wanted the things that we were seeing on TV and in our coloring books. So it was really quite easy for all the cousins to just get together and we cooked the meal. And over the years, we just kind of perfected it. And it became a thing that the adults really looked forward to, because it was the one day of the year they got to just like sit back and enjoy the food. Yeah.
If I were in charge at 13, there'd be a whole lot of desserts. Is that what happened for you?
Yeah, absolutely. We definitely prioritize the pies, and my cousin makes a great banana pudding. There was a lot of dessert, yeah.
Now, for people getting ready for Thanksgiving, it can be a big production. I mean, some people like that, of course. But why do you make the case that we should maybe push the easy button when we can and spend more time with the people we invited over in the first place?
You know, I feel this way about cooking in general. I just think when the stress is taken out of the equation, the food just comes out better. my mom always says not to cook when you're stressed, which is always not always the case that you can do that. But on Thanksgiving, you really can just make everything the day before. So many dishes can be reheated the day of. So there's just no reason to do all the cooking the day of. And when you do that, your experience is just so much more fun. And you could enjoy the holiday with your friends and your family.
Yeah, what are the key kind of dishes we can make Wednesday night and know they're going to heat up just fine tomorrow?
Oh, yeah, gravy for sure. I think people think that you have to make gravy a la minute, but you really don't. I think any cheesy casserole, stuffing is something that I make ahead of time, and I bake it off the day of. But like mac and cheese, there's so many things that you can make the night before, and then you just have to reheat them in the oven. Potatoes, even salads, like people forget to have like a fresh crunchy thing on the table. And with salads, you can do all the vegetable prep before, and you make the vinaigrette, and then you just combine them later. Nothing has to be made a la minute, except for the turkey, maybe. I like turkey the day of.
It's Food Friday. We're talking to Eric Kim from the New York Times food section about simplifying Thanksgiving. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you found ways to make great food for the holiday without, you know, just parking yourself in the kitchen all day long while everybody else is having all the fun? Or do you like making that big production? Or you don't want to talk to everybody there, so you want to make the food? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Eric, when I'm in charge of Thanksgiving, I worry that people think I'm the Grinch that stole Thanksgiving, because I don't want to have anything to do with making a whole turkey. And you say that's okay, and you've even got a bone-in turkey breast recipe that comes out great that you shared with us. Can you tell us a little bit about this one?
Yeah, I love a bone-in turkey breast, because at least you have the bone in there. But if you have, you know, a breast, it cooks more evenly, because frankly, a whole turkey, it's so big, it doesn't cook evenly. So the breast dries out before the dark meat is done. So when you have them in parts, whether you like breasts or turkey thighs or turkey legs, I think cooking them separately anyway from the start, just it makes a lot of difference. And you can pull out the breast earlier. I just think it makes a lot of sense for the anatomy of the bird to be cooking them in parts. Yeah.
We've got this recipe posted at WPR.org/Food Friday. It is salt and pepper roast turkey breast. And this brings up another element you're pushing for. There are 5 ingredients in this recipe. You don't want us like worried about this long shopping list when we're coming up with our ideas.
Yeah, for sure. I think in addition to the stress that is caused by the cooking, I really think it's the shopping that can seem really unbearable sometimes. It's like this in regular cooking, but, you know, with this turkey breast especially, turkey is so aromatic. It's just, when I was testing this, I had it in my oven and it just perfumed my apartment with turkiness. And turkey has a beautiful kind of gamey, like aromatic flavor. And I just don't think you'd need to do that much to it. I like to tumble the plate with lemon wedges, and I think it looks really bountiful, and you can squeeze some lemon on your turkey too if you want. But yeah, that's how I do it.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Valerie is with us in Burlington. Valerie, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What did you want to bring up, Valerie?
Well, I wanted to bring up that, you know, like your guest was saying, that a lot of things can be made before. And I really enjoy making the cranberry sauce beforehand. And I found that you can do it about a week ahead of time if you want. I like to grate a little orange zest into my cranberry sauce. And, you know, if you like the more boozy kind of cranberry sauce, like the adult version, you could always put like an orange flavored liqueur or like a Grand Marnier that goes along nicely into it. And it stays in the fridge for quite a while. So
I love it. And Valerie, do you make the turkey day of, or do you make turkey at all?
A turkey day of, definitely. You know, your guest said to make the gravy before. I like to use the drippings from the turkey to make my gravy, but, you know, each to his own.
Valerie, thanks so much. Do you have some thoughts on cranberry sauce, Eric?
Yeah, I do. She's exactly right. Cranberry sauce is the thing that you can make way ahead. It keeps really well in the fridge because there's so much acid and sugar. But my favorite cranberry sauce, my family's favorite cranberry sauce, is actually making like a cranberry relish. Usually it'd be with like a whole orange, raw cranberries and sugar, and that's it. But this year I swapped out the orange for a whole lemon, and it's delicious because I love the bitterness of a lemon. And I think some bitterness on the table is really, really refreshing against all the other flavors and kind of cuts through. It's really nice.
Thanks for that call, Valerie. I worry, I mean, cranberries are pretty tart and a lemon's pretty tart. It seems pretty puckertastic with this recipe. How do you balance that out?
Just the sugar. The sugar does all the work. And another thing, too, is people don't remember that lemon flesh is actually, it's sour, but it's also sweet. Yeah. It's both. So
I can see that. All right. Thanks a lot for calling in, Valerie. Maybe I'll try that sometime. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. This one I liked. Stuffing. People want the stuffing. You've got a recipe. And again, we have this at WPR.org/Food Friday. Cheesy pizza stuffing?
Yeah. It's definitely my, I'm kind of like having fun with it. Stuffing is my favorite dish, and I love the onion and sage and the regular, you know, traditional stuff. But I really, you know, I tried this one night. It's not as crazy as it sounds. You're blooming tomato paste and dried oregano into butter and onions and threading that through some mozzarella-laden, you know, bread, brioche bread. And this is just like this cheesy, custardy-bound thing that tastes really wonderful, and it tastes like pizza. And that's why I'm called it cheesy pizza stuffing. It really, if I called it like tomato cheese, you know, stuffing, that would have been another thing too. But I do love stuffing, yeah.
You have one great piece of advice, because I worry, you know, the turkey's going to cook at this temperature and the baked potato dish or whatever at that temperature. You want to streamline things and figure out recipes that can all bake at the same temperature. How do we accomplish that?
Yeah, I think all my menu on the New York Times is 7 recipes. Nothing cooks at a temperature other than 350 degrees, because I think that's like the perfect temperature for turkey. Like, turkey actually can get crispy over time at that temperature. And if it's a higher temperature, you risk drying it out. And casseroles are great at 350. If you have recipes that call for 375 or 325 or even 400, it really isn't gonna change it too much if you cook it at 350. You just have to watch it and, you know, adjust accordingly. But I really don't think we need to change the temperature of the oven. It just stick to one temperature, whether it's 400 or 350, whatever you prefer. It really will make your life easier. And I just think that gymnastics with the oven is something that's I find really annoying.
It's Food Friday. We're finding out how to have a simpler, easier, but still satisfying Thanksgiving meal. Eric Kim is with us, cooking writer for the New York Times food section and New York Times Cooking. We've got two of his recipes posted at WPR.org/Food Friday. There's the salt and pepper roast turkey breast and cheesy pizza stuffing. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What is on your Thanksgiving menu? You getting ready to go shopping in a couple few hours? Like I am? Are you going to do an entire turkey with all the fixins? Or are you going to try to scale back? Do you feel overwhelmed sometimes if you're cooking that meal for a lot of people? Do you need some advice on how to streamline? And do you do turkey? Do you do turkey breasts? Or do you do something else altogether? I've done that a couple times. You could join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. It's Food Friday. We're talking about Thanksgiving dinner and how to make it simpler so we spend less time in the kitchen on the day of, more time with the people we invited over. Our guest says the key is to cook smarter, not harder. Among his recommendations, do a lot of the stuff on Thanksgiving Eve and take it easy on the ingredients. You can keep things simpler. Eric Kim is a cooking writer for the New York Times food section, author of Korean American Food That Tastes Like Home. That comes out in March. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. If you have some time and or labor saving ideas for your Thanksgiving meals that you want to share, or maybe a story about a Thanksgiving meal gone wrong. I've been there for an oven fire when somebody had trouble with their turkey. Wasn't me. Not that time anyway. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's go back to your calls. Rocky is with us in Niscarro. Rocky, hi.
Hey, how are we doing today?
Good. What do you got for us, Rocky?
Well, my son told me about a deal where a deep fat fryer is great for cooking, but we had to do it out in the garage and it was cold. But I bought a deep fat fryer you can do in the house. The one I got will only cook up to a 16-pound turkey, but you can get them bigger. But takes an hour and a half to cook a turkey, and it's nice and juicy and tender and all kinds of good things. So you don't have to worry about setting the oven for the turkey and then adjusting all that stuff.
Rocky, thanks a lot for that. What do you think, Eric, the deep fat fryer for the turkey?
Oh, I'm a huge fan. I think it's delicious, but I live in a tiny shoebox studio in Manhattan, so I don't really have access to that. But I really, if you have access to that, definitely do that. That's delicious.
Thanks a lot for the call, Rocky, at 800-642-1234. We heard from Mark, who couldn't stay with us, but says, hey, if you want to skip the turkey, you can go vegan, and there are lots of yummy vegan dishes that work for Thanksgiving. Do you have any, Eric, ideas for a good entree, a vegan entree for Thanksgiving Day?
I do. The first one that comes to mind is my colleague Lex's. It's a vegetarian mushroom Wellington. Ooh. I just think it's such a, I don't know if it's vegan actually, but it's such a delicious centerpiece. It's really special. And you know, mushrooms have so much umami, so it's like this savoriness that triggers, like, you know, the glutamate, you know, response on your tongue and makes you think of meat, honestly, and other things like that. But I would recommend that recipe on NYT Cooking. My family loves rice, so if I had a vegan or vegetarian guest, I would probably make a risotto for them, something really special. Yeah.
That sounds good. Let's go back to your calls now at 800-642-1234. Sandy is with us now in Ferryville. Sandy, hi.
Hi. A question. I saw on a cooking show, they removed the backbone of the turkey and they just spread it out and they broke the breast bones somewhat.
Nice.
And then just laid the turkey out and roasted it. And I wondered if that is a good idea or not such a good idea.
Interesting. I've never seen that, Eric. Have you?
Yeah, it's called spatchcocking. It just means removing the back spine, and it's a really great idea because it will make your turkey cook more evenly. One thing is you kind of need good scissors or like kitchen shears, the ones that are like actual poultry shears, because turkeys can be really hard to break through that bone. But otherwise, if you have good scissors, it's a really great way to cook the turkey. It also cooks way faster. And more evenly, like I said, so it's a great idea. And also, I would like do the buttermilk brine. Sameen Nasrat on our NYT Cooking app has this wonderful buttermilk brined spatchcock turkey recipe, and it's really great. Yeah.
Sandy, thanks.
I think it's great.
Good luck with that, Sandy. Let us know how it goes. You mentioned the B word there, Eric, brining, and I know I don't care that much one way or the other. Some people really feel passionately pro or con on brining. What are your thoughts?
Oh, yeah. I think if you have the organization and the wherewithal to do that, like the day or two in advance, I would, because it really, it's insurance, not just against dryness, but also against blandness. With that said, for me, realistically, I know that I'm getting my turkey maybe a day or two before, and that sounds ironic, because I'm like, I just wrote about turkey, but I've never organized enough to really, my turkey's always frozen, honestly, the morning of Thanksgiving. So I'm usually doing it a la minute. But my recipe for the salt and pepper roast turkey breast, it actually calls for letting it come to room temperature with like butter and salt on it. And it's not a dry brine, but it's like enough time for the seasoning to kind of penetrate. And it's sort of, I think if you have the time and you're organized, you should.
Thanks a lot for that call. We'll go to Linda now in Milwaukee. Linda, hi.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good. What did you want to tell us about, Linda?
Well, I have a small, time I have to do my turkey. I don't do turkey anymore. I do a roast chicken. But I'm wondering, I use a clay pot that I found out is just wonderful. You put your bird in the clay pot, it soaks, and then you put it at high heat and it gets it done so well. I have never tried it with like a turkey breast, but what does your guests think about that?
I think I've never like done that. I've never played with that, but mm-hmm. I think it sounds really interesting. I think for me, I like the heat of the oven, and I think my oven's pretty small anyway, so it kind of produces like a nice environment for something like a turkey breast. So I usually just stick to roasting and I keep things simple, but I think that's really cool that you discovered that and sounds really delicious.
Sounds good, Linda. Thanks a lot for the call at 800-642-1234. Eric Kim is with us from the New York Times food section, looking at easier ways to make our Thanksgiving meal less labor, at least on the day of, so we could spend more time with the people we invited over. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Gene is with us now, calling from Ashland. Gene, hi.
Hello. My story is when our grown children were young adults and they brought home their mates and our new spouses for Thanksgiving. Our dining room table is over 100 years old. And just as I was going to put the turkey on, the table fell apart. So the whole middle came down. So the men got under with hammer and nails and screws and nuts and bolts and put it back together, and then we ate dinner.
No, wait. Was there any food fallout? Was there food on the part that collapsed?
It slid. But we caught it all. And then, and I still have the table. We had it rebuilt, and it's still in the dining room.
All right. And it's held up for every meal since?
It has, because it's been rebuilt.
Excellent. Jean, thanks so much. I'm glad you were able to salvage Thanksgiving that way. Eric, have you had any holiday cooking fiascos? I mentioned, you know, the oven on fire scenario with the turkey.
Yeah, which ones have I not had? But yeah, the one year I did cause a fire in my building and everyone was evacuated and I kind of ruined it. Everyone's Thanksgiving. I felt so bad. But I would say I got to a place where just Thanksgiving was really foolproof for me. That sounds like I'm bragging. I just mean that I think I keep it simple every year because this is my job. So, yeah.
Thanks a lot for sharing that story. I love it. So, Eric, we've got your turkey breast recipe, your stuffing recipe, the cheesy pizza stuffing. We started talking about dessert, though, because you were making Thanksgiving when you were a kid. What kind of desserts do you turn to now for Thanksgiving or other big holidays?
Yeah, for Thanksgiving, you know, banana pudding, I'm from the South, and that was a big dish at our Thanksgiving table. So I kind of took that and turned it into a caramel apple pudding. So in place of the bananas, I do this lovely like caramel apple apple mix, and I layer that with some salted cinnamon whipped cream, some vanilla wafers. You could do ginger snaps, whatever cookie you like. And as those layers sit in the fridge overnight, they like turn into a cake, like an icebox cake almost. And I just love that texture and that lightness right after a heavy meal. But I definitely still need a pie. I'm going to make like a cranberry curd pie this year, probably. David Tanis on NYT Cooking has an amazing recipe that's so popular. It's like 5,000 five stars. So I just have to see what that's about. Yeah.
Now, Eric, I'm the proud owner of a freezer full of Long Island cheese pumpkin. So I'm going to make pie with some of it. Do you have any pumpkin pie thoughts? Because I honestly haven't made a lot of those in my life.
I love pumpkin pie. I think one thing that people don't know is that the Libby's can is actually squash. And so when you're making your pumpkin pie, like, you don't have to use real pumpkin. And in fact, that flavor is really muddied and it's not the right flavor that you're expecting. So my colleague Melissa Clark developed this perfect pumpkin pie recipe where she roasts butternut squash, and it's actually a butternut squash pie, but it's pumpkin pie. It's the pumpkin pie that we know and that we grew up with here in the States. So that's my thoughts on pumpkin pie, I'd say. Oh, also, you need whipped cream or vanilla ice cream, at least. I like both of those.
Okay. Homemade whipped cream, or do you like the spray can?
Oh, the spray can's great, but I like homemade whipped cream because I salt mine pretty ferociously. And it sounds weird, but it's super flavorful if you salt it just enough and some cinnamon in there. It's a really nice whipped cream. And sugar, of course. Yeah.
And what is, are you cooking for people this Thanksgiving, or are you going to somebody else's and not having to do any of the work?
I'm cooking with my partner, actually. We're just staying here in New York and having a chill time. I'm thinking of doing like a turkey thigh, you know. I love poultry thighs, so I think I'm going to try something like that. I just want to try something else because in a food writer's life, you sort of do the Thanksgiving months in advance for coverage. And it's just, yeah, so usually the day of, you kind of relax a little bit.
I love it. Eric, thanks so much for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Bless.
That's Eric Kim, cooking writer for the New York Times food section, New York Times Cooking, and a columnist for the New York Times Magazine. He's the author of the forthcoming cookbook, Korean American Food That Tastes Like Home. We talked to them today about how to simplify our Thanksgiving dinners. We've got a couple of his recipes posted at WPR.org/Food Friday. You can check out the salt and pepper roast turkey breast, along with the cheesy pizza stuffing. Give them a test run if you'd like this weekend. Let us know how they turned out at the Ideas Network Facebook page. And while you're there, tell us your secret to a fun yet delicious and not hopefully too stressful Thanksgiving meal. Again, share your story on the Ideas Network Facebook page or tweet us at Central Time WPR. Coming up Monday on The Morning Show, from the pandemic to addictions and overdoses, the nation's public health system has faced big tests over the last couple of years. Check out a conversation between Kate Archer-Kent and Dr. Leanna Wen, author of the new book, Lifelines. That's Monday at 8 on the Ideas Network. Yesterday, I previewed this morning's long-running partial eclipse of the moon. Did you watch it? Did you take pictures? Let us know. Share your photos, if any. Tweet us at Central Time WPR or email ideas at WPR.org. And if you're wondering, did I check it out? The answer is a little bit. I had made plans, but there I was. It was 12:30. I was still up reading, and I thought, just one more hour and I can give it a look. But I was really tired. My compromise plan, laid down on the couch, fell asleep for an hour. Got up at 1:30, headed out into the cold. I caught the early stage. I could see the moon getting shadowed out by the very planet I was standing on. Then I realized if I wanted to see the full experience with the weird color and whatnot, I was going to have to stay up for at least another hour. So I went to bed. There are cool pictures online, and you can share yours or your own lunar eclipse experience. Tweet us at Central Time WPR or email ideas at WPR.org. This is a fairly well-rested Central Time.